From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Sudden Dead. I suppose few of the London bridges have witnessed more suicides than the old Waterloo and Westminster bridges, which at the turn of the century had an especially bad name for these tragedies. When my wanderings in those years led me across one or other of the two bridges, it was no uncommon thing to hear a shouting and screaming and to see a number of people suddenly rush and peer over the side of the bridge into the brown depths below. What has happened? Someone would ask. Oh, only another suicide would be the reply, and you would probably see a small paragraph in either the evening or morning newspapers reporting that some poor wretch, thinking to find a way out of his or her sorrows and difficulties, had jumped into the Thames. Mainly because of the unemployment situation, quite a large portion of the suicides in those days were women. I once talked to the policeman who had one or two strange tales to tell about Westminster Bridge. People say, he told me, that queer things are seen at times during the night on this bridge, and I can quite believe it because, although I've never actually seen anything myself, I've heard something on several occasions that I could not account for. Late one night, exactly 2 years ago, I was crossing the bridge while off duty and got about two-thirds the way over. I was bound for Kennington, where I live, when someone tapped me gently on the shoulder and a voice, which sounded like a woman, said in a very clear, distinct tones, "This is the spot. This is the spot." I turned around, but no one was anywhere near me. The same thing happened again the next night, and the night after, at the same time, and in about the same place. Well, the following night, I had reached that spot and was fully expecting any moment to hear the voice for a fourth time, when a man suddenly rushed across the pavement in front of me and began to climb the wall with the obvious intention of jumping over into the river. I was just in time to prevent him. He didn't struggle but behaved quite normally and naturally, so I did not take him into custody. He told me he was a clerk, that he had been out of work for some time and had come to the end of his tether. I reasoned with him and saw him off the bridge after I had given him a few pence, all I could afford, and he had promised me he would try again for a job the following day. I left him. I never saw or heard of him again, but I've always wondered what that voice was and whether it had anything to do with his suicide attempt. "Did you ever hear the voice again?" I asked. "No," he said, "never. Though I've crossed the bridge many times since, at all hours of the night and morning." The constable also told me that the figure of a man with a very white face and a black mustache, wearing a top hat and frock coat, was said to be seen occasionally at midnight jumping off Westminster Bridge. A man dressed like that, he explained, did actually commit suicide off the bridge on the stroke of 12 one night in December 1889, and as that no more Whitechapel atrocities took place, he was thought by some to be Jack the Ripper. Anyway, whether he was Jack the Ripper or not, it's the ghost of this man which people occasionally see jumping over. But from my own experience, it seems pretty clear that the bridge is haunted, not by one ghost, but by several. Another Westminster haunting is associated with one of the old ferry steamboats which plied between Greenwich and Westminster. A young man who was traveling on this steamboat one sunny summer's day noticed sitting on a deck, rather away from everyone else, a woman whose face was hidden by a black veil. Judging by her figure and hands, she appeared to be quite young, and the young man consequently took more than a casual interest in her. When the boat was within a few yards of Westminster Bridge, she suddenly sprang up and, to his surprise and horror, jumped overboard. In an instant, he took off his coat and plunged in after her. Fortunately, he was an excellent swimmer, but though he looked around everywhere, he could not see any sign of the girl. Giving up in despair, he swam back to the steamer and was helped on board by several of the passengers and crew. In his exhausted state, his feelings may be imagined when the captain said to him, "You are the third person this week who has jumped in after that creature." "What?" the young man cried. "Do you mean to tell me she was merely playing a trick? But what became of her? Where did she go? I could find no sign of her in the water." "What becomes of her is more than I or anyone else can tell you," the captain told them solemnly. The young man eyed him in sheer disbelief. "Are you saying she was something supernatural?" The captain shrugged. "I don't know how else to account for it," he said. He then told the would-be rescuer that sometime previously a girl, the exact counterpart of the one he had just tried to save, had actually jumped off the steamer in that same spot and drowned, and that ever since the steamer had been periodically haunted by what he and others believe to be her apparition. Yet another elusive ghost of Westminster Bridge. Incidentally, it's a phantom boat. Two or three men whose faces are too indistinct and shadowy to be recognizable are aboard her, and she is seen to approach and go under the bridge, but never to appear on the other side. People have searched for her on the other side, but have yet been able to discover the slightest trace of her. Away from the river, one suicide that created a very great sensation at the time was that of the Irish Member of Parliament, John Sadleir. This tragedy occurred on Hampstead Heath. His body was found by a laborer at about 8:30 a.m. on Sunday, February 17, 1856, on a mound of grass at the back of the public house, Jack Straw's Castle. Sadleir lay on his back, his head resting quite peacefully, close to a furze bush, and by his side a bottle labeled poison and essential oil of almonds. On it becoming known that the body was that of a well-known member of Parliament, great interest and sympathy were aroused. But the sympathy evaporated when the public learned that John Sadleir had led a secret life of sin and was nothing more or less than a common rogue. So much is now mere history, but it is not generally known that for some years after the discovery of Sadleir's body, the place where it was found was said to be haunted by his ghost. In the autumn of 1898, when having a meal one evening at Jack Straw's Castle, I got into conversation with a retired commercial traveler who told me of a strange experience he had once had when passing near the scene of Sadleir's death. It happened in the summer of 1857. The traveler told me he was crossing the heath alone one evening, and when he was within 100 yards or so of the place where the MP's body was found, 12 months previously, a man in a top hat, whom he described as being well but not smartly dressed, suddenly emerged from some bushes and commenced walking in front of him. As the man's back was turned to the traveler, he could not see his face, but from the man's general appearance and the briskness of his walk, he judged him to be about 40 years of age. After the man had walked a few yards, my informant suddenly became conscious of a stillness in the air, and noticed that although his own steps made a slight noise and awoke a faint echo, he could not hear those of the stranger. This aroused his curiosity, and he next noticed that although his own shadow appeared on the ground by his side, the stranger apparently had no shadow. However, the man looked so material and altogether natural that to the traveler it seemed impossible that he could be other than a creature of flesh and blood like himself. And so the two of them continued to advance till they came to a clump of bushes. The stranger then abruptly, swerving aside, plunged into the bushes and disappeared. Immediately afterwards, a series of dreadful moans and groans came, so the traveler thought, from the bushes, but on thoroughly searching among them, he found no one. There was no trace anywhere of the mysterious stranger. He had completely vanished. My informant had heard it rumored that the spot was haunted, and after his fruitless search, he came to the conclusion that for once in a way, rumor was right. The sinister reputation attaching to this part of the heath through John Sadleir's suicide and subsequent appearances was increased when about 2 years later, Mr. Pryor, A hosier likewise took poison there, choosing for the scene of his suicide a spot not very far away from that selected for the same purpose by John Sadleir. I should add that Mr. Pryor's ghost too was said to haunt a heath, appearing as a rule near to some fir trees in the vicinity of which his body was found. If deeds of violence are a cause of haunting, the London district of Blackheath certainly ought to have its phantoms, for it has been the scene of several very grim and gruesome mysteries, some long since forgotten. One rather vivid case that was brought to my notice by witnesses was that of the skeleton of Shooter's Hill. At Shooter's Hill in the late 1830s, people passing by a certain spot in the neighborhood at night reported hearing unaccountable noises and occasionally seeing the phantom of a woman in a white dress gliding about the ground. She was always spoken of as the White Lady. Not one of the witnesses was seriously believed, yet after a few years they were vindicated in the most inarguable fashion. In January 1844, a laborer working 30 yards from the high road leading to Shooter's Hill in the allegedly haunted area unearthed the skeleton of a woman. A terrible fracture of the back of the skull indicated that she had met with foul play, and that she had not been dead very long, suggested by the fact that much beautifully braided golden hair still adhered to the skull. The hair, however, proved no clue to her identity, and so the remains were properly interred in a churchyard, and the mystery relating to her soon forgotten. But the unfortunate woman's ghost still lingered on. While living in St. John's Park, Blackheath, in 1898, I met several people who remembered the subsequent reappearance of it. One was Mr. Eric Johnson, a man of independent means, then staying in Lewisham. As a boy, he told me he remembered the following incident being frequently narrated by his father, usually when they had friends to the house. To be brief, Mr. Johnson Sr., on his way home one night, was walking down Shooter's Hill, which at that time was still a very lonely and deserted locality after dusk, when he heard a cry of such terror and despair that he stopped at once. While he stood listening, the cry was repeated, seeming to come from a spot close at hand. He called out, but there was no reply. Then after an interval of a minute or so, the cry was repeated, and a woman in a white dress rose from the ground, some little way ahead of him. The moonlight being, so it seemed, focused on her, he was able to see her very distinctly, and thinking she was ill and wanted assistance, he ran towards her. To his intense surprise, however, when he was within a few yards of her, she vanished. There was nothing in sight to afford cover, so she could not have hidden. Mr. Johnson, greatly wondering, resumed his walk home, but he had not covered many more yards before he heard the same cry again, this time very close at hand. Although by no means a timid man, he was now thoroughly frightened, being convinced that what he had heard and seen was nothing earthly, and fearing that if he delayed he might see the figure again, he ran the rest of the way home. Mr. Johnson had not heard of the haunting prior to this, and so was very relieved to learn that the phantom he had been seen by others. He never, his son added, passed the place again at night alone. Nearly 30 years after Shooter's Hill once again came into unpleasant notoriety, the district of Kidbrook, which lies immediately between Blackheath and Shooter's Hill, was then very thinly populated, and one of the loneliest thoroughfares it was Kidbrook Lane. At 20 minutes to 7 on the evening of April 25th, 1871, a pretty servant maid named Jane Maria Clausen said a laughing goodbye to a girlfriend in Kidbrook and was never seen by her again alive. Some hours later, Jane was found lying unconscious in Kidbrook Lane, having been struck on the head with a hammer dropped at her side. She died shortly afterwards without regaining consciousness, the suspicion of the police falling at once on a young man named Edmund Pook, whose father had formerly employed Jane Clausen as a servant. They arrested him. A Mr. Lazelle declared an oath that he saw Pook in Jane's company at 7:10 on the evening of the murder, close to the spot where she was afterwards found. Dr. Leatherby, who examined Pook's clothes, testified to there being blood on the young man's trousers, and the police produced evidence to show that Pook bought a hammer shortly before the murder at the shop of a Mr. Thomas. all of which testimony seemed to many minds convincing. But as Pook was able to produce an alibi to show he could not have been in Kidbrook Lane at the time of the murder was believed to have taken place, he was acquitted, and no one else being arrested, the crime was consigned to the category of unsolved mysteries. In certain respects, the tragedy resembled that discovered in 1844. In each case, the victim was a young woman. The skulls of both were battered in, and the places where the bodies were found were very lonely and not far apart. After the murder, Kidbrook Lane was claimed to be haunted nightly by cries and groans and the apparition of the murdered girl. Such persistent stories indeed got into circulation that the lane for some long time was shunned by nearly everyone after dark. Sometimes a haunting following an act of violence will persist for years, over centuries, even recurring at irregular intervals. More frequently, a haunting will occur immediately after the violence and then recur perhaps once or twice over a short period of years. As an example of the more immediate lingering echo of violence, few cases can be stranger than a haunting in Whitechapel at the time of Jack the Ripper. Late one night, about a month after the murder of Lizzie Stride, a Whitechapel tradesman was passing along Burner Street towards the end that leads into Commercial Road when his ears were chilled by a series of the most harrowing moans and groans. He looked round him everywhere but could not find or locate the sounds. Thinking that the Ripper had been at his work again or that someone was taken violently ill, he ran to tell people passing by of the sounds, and in less time than it takes to tell quite a small crowd had collected. The tradesman then, although he did not think the moans and groans actually came from it, was about to knock at the door of one of the houses when a woman in the crowd called out, "It's no good knocking there, Governor. Them sounds don't come from that house. They're in the street here. We've often eared 'em since poor Lizzie was done to death close to this here spot." I also heard from several sources that the house in Miller's Court, Dorset Street, Spitalfields, where Mary Janet Kelly was murdered, was afterwards haunted. A woman in black, said to be the ghost of poor Mary, was often seen entering the house and looking out of its windows, while strange sounds were heard proceeding from it. The ghosts of violence are, without doubt, among the most pathetic and distressing phantoms we ever do see.